Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The one way to be sure not to be nervous about canning is to keep a clean kitchen, sterilize the materials beforehand, and use a recipe. If you're doing all of those things, you have very little reason to worry.
Stephanie Solomon is back, along with Marcia Veldman and Lori Heber. Along with canning tips, they talk about their favorite salsa recipes. Chef Daniel Orr throws together some salsa using tomatillos from his garden. Before that, a homemade pizza is a perfect way to use up lots of the veggies you're harvesting these days. We visit the Fort Knox of Seeds in Colorado with Harvest Public Media. And speaking of seeds, author Janice Ray's book, Seed Underground, reminds us that every morsel of food comes from a seed. Food news headlines at the top of every show. Luann Johnson, what do you got?
Researchers in Baltimore have perfected a fish food recipe that can turn tasty marine carnivores into vegans. For years, scientists have been cooking up combinations of plant-derived nutrients to replace wild-caught species used to fatten high-demand predators sold in supermarkets. Nearly half of the world's fish and seafood is raised in tanks instead of caught in the wild. Aquaculture has the potential to take pressure off of depleted fisheries, but not when farms still depend on fish meal from wild sources like Atlantic sardines and anchovies. It turns out that cobia, a fish fillet popular in Europe and Asia that's gaining ground in the U.S., don't like barley or wheat gluten. It took the team 4 years to get it just right. The fish food chefs base their recipe on diets used for rainbow trout. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the Department of Agriculture have been pushing research on alternatives to support aquaculture since at least 2007. This year's weather in Indiana has been unusually consistent. Sunny days followed by cool nights, and farmers are reaping the rewards. Indiana's corn farmers are experiencing a huge turnaround from last year's drought-ravaged fields as a new report forecasts near-record level production. That could mean over 970 million bushels of corn come harvest time, a 64% increase in production from 2012. Wineries are also excited about the mild summer weather. Butler Winery is on track to have their best season ever, but vineyard owners aren't popping their corks just yet. Having a continental climate can make Indiana's growing seasons unpredictable, and it is still a month until harvest. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org.
Twitter and Facebook were all over social media, sharing food news throughout the week. Search for Earth Eats. Luann Johnson, thanks for the news.
My pleasure.
When genetically modified wheat was found growing in Oregon earlier this year, it didn't take long for accusations to start flying. No one knew how the unapproved wheat ended up in the ground. A flurry of finger-pointing cast potential blame on a federal seed vault in Colorado, which housed the same strain of the wheat. The facility's been cleared of wrongdoing since then, but the investigation brings up questions of how secure these seed vaults actually are. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon took a tour of the Colorado vault and filed this report.
I'm standing here in front of the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation, which is just a fancy way of saying seed vault. It's a pretty nondescript building. It's beige with a red roof, 3 stories tall. But it's the nation's largest collection of seeds, genetic material for livestock and microbes. So let's go inside and see what's going on. Inside the facility, good luck getting past the lobby without a key card and passcode. Locked doors are around every corner. Luckily, I have a tour guide.
My name's Dave Dierig. I'm the research leader here at NCGRP. That's the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Dierig is in charge of the seed vault and one of the 6 people inside who has access to the main vaults where seeds and animal embryos are kept.
So, yeah, these are the doors to the vault.
We're about to head into the facility's black box storage room. Think of it like a series of safety deposit boxes in a bank. Other seed vaults throughout the world send their backup collections here. So do some private companies like DuPont and Monsanto. The room is kept at the same temperature as your home freezer, fur-lined parkas hang on a rack just outside large gray metal doors. Is it chilly inside?
Yeah, it is. You may want to put on a jacket, but it actually feels kind of good now that it's summertime.
To the right of the doors, a TV screen shows a live stream of the seed vault. It serves as another reminder of the building's security. In this place, you're always on camera.
Deep breath. We won't stay in here too long, but...
Inside, ceiling-high shelves hold seemingly endless rows of white pouches. In this room, there are 600,000 seed packets, which puts the total number of seeds in the billions. Some are here purely for storage, but researchers can also request seeds for studies.
And then they're all barcoded, so we know exactly where everything is.
That's another security measure. Looking at a seed pouch, there's nothing that tells you what kind of seeds you're holding, just a barcode. You need access to a secure database to find out what's inside. Downstairs, behind another series of heavy metal doors and under the watchful eye of security cameras, are long rows of stainless steel capsules. They're filled with liquid nitrogen to store seeds, livestock semen, and fish eggs.
We have anything from fish to cattle to sheep. We even do some cattle blood. But pretty much that's what we do so that we can put it in our big database and it's accessible and we know where it is.
Lab technician Angela Sosa is transferring Chinook salmon eggs from one container to another, placing them back into the liquid nitrogen. She's another of the handful of people with access to this room. The facility has been compared to Fort Knox in its level of security. But earlier this summer, that formidable reputation was thrown into question. For 7 years, this same vault kept about 1,500 pounds of Monsanto's genetically modified wheat seeds, including the same strain found growing in small patches in Oregon.
It would really be a rare case where we would keep another company's seed. There would have to be some kind of extenuating circumstances for them to say, we need you to keep this seed.
It's a rare occasion, but as in the Monsanto case, it does happen. Research leader Dave Dierig says he can't comment on the specifics of the Oregon case, as Department of Agriculture investigators are still trying to pin down the seed source. A department spokesman says all of Monsanto's wheat seeds held at the vault were incinerated 2 years ago at the request of the company. With the investigation turning in other directions, this beige building in Colorado can return to business as usual, securely storing the world's seeds. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. As many ways to enjoy your salsa as there are heirloom varieties of tomatoes. That was one of the topics that got our three gardening and cooking experts excited during a special Noon Edition program on WFIU a few weeks ago. Lori Heber says when making salsa, there are certain flavor profiles to keep in mind. She was joined by Stephanie Solomon of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard and Marcia Veldman of the Bloomington Community Farmers Market.
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to salsa making, you really have to think along the, you know, heat, sweet, sour, and savory, you know, to really, you know, if you have elements of each of those things, it's hard to go wrong. And then you think about texture. You know, you want something that's soft and then you want something that's crunchy. And so you want to think about the texture of your salsa, too. But I'm partial to, a black bean mango salsa with some jalapeno and onions and garlic. I mean, that really speaks to me. A little squeeze of lemon.
Stephanie, what do you got?
I have to say peach salsa is my favorite. Peaches and then those ripening heirloom tomatoes. A lot of garlic. I'm a garlic fan. And I've grown into more of a tolerance for heat, so maybe some hot peppers in there, but I'm moderate. But yeah, that peach and tomato, I love the sweetness.
Solomon grew up not liking tomatoes until she realized that the flavorless tomatoes she bought at the grocery store were nothing like heirloom varieties she could grow herself, like her personal favorite, the green zebra. She loves the sweetness and the acid level of that variety, says it's perfect for what she likes in salsa.
But I have to say, my favorite thing about growing a diversity of tomatoes is that if you make a salsa or you can even just whole tomatoes and you have a lot of different varieties, there's just something about that flavor that you can't find in a grocery store canned tomato.
If people are thinking, gosh, I didn't plant any of these in my garden this year, but next spring I got to get on that. At what time are we planting tomatoes?
Right around Mother's Day. And surprisingly, this year it was kind of chilly. And the thing that gets confusing is that the tomatoes start being sold sometimes early in April. And then people think, oh, this beautiful tomato, I'll put it in the ground. But really, tomatoes like a warm soil. And so I use Mother's Day as a rule of thumb and think of that as kind of the ideal weekend to plant my tomatoes.
Yeah, the average last frost in this part of the world is May 15th, which generally coincides nicely with Mother's Day. But you're right, they do not like to be cold. They like warm soil. Same with peppers, same with eggplants. They're definitely warm season plants that want it warm. And you can start them as seed early on, February, March or so. That's one of the reasons that you get those beautiful plants that I've seen them in bloom and bearing fruit in the greenhouse in April. But you have to resist the temptation to put them in the ground.
We were talking about canning. I want to keep talking about canning. I think we need to encourage people to try it. What are some examples of surefire bets for canning foods?
Tomatoes are a real good one. Jams and jellies are easy to can, and most fruits are pretty high acidic. Your berries are, and peaches are a good one, even not as a jam. Just canning peaches, they taste wonderful canned. They're good frozen as well.
Okay, frozen.
And then they're things where you add vinegar, where you're pickling. I like doing pickled jalapenos. I just really like those a lot. Mm-hmm. But once you're adding that vinegar, it will bring up the acidity so that it creates a pretty inhospitable environment to any bacterial growth.
If we can just do like a quick how-to, what are the basic steps of canning?
I can do that. I love to can. It's a great community thing. These steps may sound intensive, but they're lots of fun. So you want to start by sterilizing, which means you boil your jars or boil the instruments you're using. And then I'll just say with tomatoes and peaches, which I think I'm a lazy cook, I'll be honest. So how I like to do it is I don't remember what it's called, but you lightly boil the tomatoes and the peaches to the point where the skin is almost falling off. And then you dunk them in cold water, and then you can take the skin off if you want or not. And then once you have your jars ready and clean, sterilized, you push your peaches or your tomatoes into the jar, leave a little bit of head space, use a plastic knife to make sure there's no air pockets, wipe the lid. So, and then you put them in to your canner. And the cool thing about hot water baths is that you don't even need an actual canner. If you have a stock pot and then you put an upside down plate in the bottom to make sure that the jars don't touch the bottom, then you're set to go. And then you put the tops on, and then you boil them. Do you know the time off the top of your head?
It depends on the recipe. And that is one thing, is following a recipe is a really good idea, because I love canning salsa and I love garlic and onions. But if you get really carried away with garlic and onions, you can then throw off the pH. So, yeah.
That's what we tell people, is the one way to be sure not to be nervous about canning is to keep a clean kitchen, sterilize the materials beforehand, and use a recipe. If you're doing all of those things, you have very little reason to worry.
If people want a fall garden, do we need to get that stuff in the ground right now?
Depends what you're growing. But a lot of those long season crops, like if you want collard greens or kale or broccoli, things like that, cabbage, you want to get them in the ground, which generally is really hard because this tends to be a dry, hot time. But this is, I think, going to be a great year for fall crops.
Mm-hmm. I typically wait until the second week of August for planting things like lettuce and arugula and carrots and radishes and turnips. And I went ahead and planted some of those things already. Just, you know, the ground's moist, the temperatures are cool. But fall crops are nice. Sometimes you can miss some of the pests that are more prevalent in the summer. Fall's a really nice time to grow, but getting the seed started sometimes can be a challenge, but this year should be a good one.
Marcia Veldman had another great idea. If you aren't lucky enough to have a glut of tomatoes from your own garden, vendors at your local farmer's market might, and they might be willing to sell them to you in bulk for a decent price. Could be worth it to ask around. Thanks to Lori Heber of Terra Foods and Stephanie Solomon of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard as well for coming in and talking about cooking your garden. Plenty of other tips and tricks at eartheats.org. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr takes us on a tour of the restaurant's pizza bar.
We have local sausage, we have pineapple, we've got kielbasa, we've got pesto, we've got prosciutto, roasted beets, roasted fennel, wine, drunken figs.
And, of course, fresh mozzarella, a great recipe that incorporates basically anything you got in your fridge. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors who have written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food by Janice Ray.
You know, it's a meditation to garden, because when you're gardening, you don't think about anything else. You're involved in the moment.
Ray has been gardening for 25 years. Saving seeds was a natural extension of that. As she says, every morsel of food we eat starts with a seed.
When I was writing the book, I was trying to remember specific incidents that had happened to me in the garden. It was very difficult because I'm not thinking about, oh, I need to write this down, and well, this would make a great story. I'm really just there.
Here's 1 minute with author Janice Ray.
Our seed supply is in crisis. Three multinational companies control half of the seed market globally. The seeds are being patented at a rapid rate, and not just laboratory inventions of hybrid seeds and genetically modified seeds, but also old, ancient, heritage, heirloom varieties being patented. That's worrisome to me because that is the control of our food supply, meaning Our seed supply is our food supply. I believe that it is a farmer's right to save seeds. I think seeds belong to the great commons of life, like air and water and fire and the ocean. Necessarily, we need sovereignty over our seed supply, which ensures all these wonderful tastes, and it ensures agrodiversity. The more diverse any system, the less the potential for it to collapse.
Yeah, enjoy your day.
Thanks.
Bye. Hear more from Janice Ray on our website. She talks about the very involved process of hand pollinating a pumpkin plant to ensure the purity of the seed. Read that at eartheats.org. Let your creativity be your guide in our first recipe here. You'll see how wacky Chef Orr gets with the toppings on his homemade pizzas. Especially if you're looking to use up some orphaned veggies in your crisper, this is the recipe for you. Going to start off by making the crust.
What we do is we get some local ground cornmeal from Wibbs Farm. You could also mix in some whole wheat flour, some buckwheat flour, a little bit of white flour. You could also buy some frozen dough and then just use that, roll it out with some local grains, and you're going to have a nice crispy crust. And what we go for here are the thin crust pizzas. So we want to roll this out really thin. And if you're having a group of friends over, a good thing to do is, like what I've done here, is we've rolled out several in advance. So then all we have to do is everybody can make their own pizza, and we can throw it in the oven, and we're good to go.
So this is going to be a fun interactive meal.
It's great for kids. Also, if you have people that you don't really know that well coming over, it's a good thing to serve them because they can make their own and you don't have to worry about anybody's, you know, allergies and all that kind of stuff.
And a good icebreaker for some conversation.
Yeah. The first thing we do is we take a little bit of olive oil and we put that on top of the pie dough. And what that does is it creates a little seal. So the sauce that we put on won't soak into the dough. A lot of times, if you want that real crispy crust, you don't want to have it soggy with a lot of tomato sauce. Okay, so I'm going to follow the olive oil up with some red sauce. Now, with these thin-crusted pizzas, what you don't want to do is to overload them, all right? Because you want that crust to stay really crisp and to be able to pick it up without having all of your toppings fall off. So it's very important you don't do too much sauce. Okay, and then you can look over here, and we have some of the wide variety of items that we can put on the pizzas. We have local sausage, we have pineapple, we've got kielbasa, we've got pesto, we've got mozzarella, fresh mozzarella. We've got olives, prosciutto, roasted beets, roasted fennel, wine, drunken figs, even mashed potatoes. Sometimes we put mashed potatoes and meatloaf
on it. Mashed potatoes?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's really, anything that you have, it's always great to kind of clean out the refrigerator, you know, use up all those ingredients. You know, you could even make a dessert pizza with some grated chocolate and some mascarpone cheese, maybe some fresh fruit on that, some strawberries. So, I mean, you can really go wild with it, and it's really up to your own imagination. Wolfgang Puck was famous for doing a sushi pizza. So he would do kind of a flatbread, and then he would put some arugula and some raw tuna and some caviar and different things on it, some sour cream. What do you think, Annie? What would you like on yours?
See, I'm eyeing those pineapples. I love pineapple pizza.
Okay, well, then we'll do what we call our spicy Latino. Okay, so we have the pineapple. I'm going to chop up some chicken. And then we're going to put on what is called a sofrito, which is a Puerto Rican pesto, which has red and green peppers and some chilies and cilantro. Sofrito was used to start a lot of the sauces and stews, and it's kind of like the Italians use their pesto, but it has a little more spice to it. Okay, and then we're going to sprinkle some jalapenos. We're going to put a little Parmesan. Then we've got some smoked Gouda. Okay, and then we put it on the pizza peel. What I like to do is to have it get a little bit brown and crunchy around the outside, a little bit of chard. I think that really adds to the flavor. The inside's going to be a little bit less cooked. Now, with the spicy Latino, I like to garnish it with some nice big sprigs of cilantro, which you can kind of wrap around the pizza. And then we put a lime wedge on it. Okay, we're just going to cut it up into nice little bites. Okay, that's a spicy Latino.
What if I'd chosen, I don't know, the sauerkraut?
Well, what we do is we call it the Oktoberfest pie. It is kielbasa and sauerkraut and smoked mozzarella. We do a big red in honor of IU, which is tomatoes and fresh mozzarella, tomato sauce. And then we put some pesto in the middle of that. We do an Italian stallion, and that is with the drunken figs and prosciutto. And then some mascarpone, we put some fresh figs on at the end.
Now we're going to make a roasted salsa using ground cherries, better known as tomatillos. We picked some tomatillos straight from the garden for this recipe.
And they look kind of like Japanese lanterns here, you know?
They really do.
So they have this kind of papery husk on the outside, and you just kind of tear that off, and there you go. It's a tomatillo. Taste this. It's almost like a fruit. I mean,
but it's still fairly mild.
Yeah, a citrusy melon. And we've got several different varieties. Some of them kind of blush purple when they're really ripe, and they turn very light colored, and those are super sweet. So let's go in the kitchen and get these roasted up. Tomatillos sometimes have kind of a sticky residue on the outside of them, so just want to give that a rinse. I'm going to chop up some onions. Okay, I'm going to add my chili pepper. We're going to put a little lemon zest in this one, 4 or 5 cloves of garlic, and I'm going to toss that with just a couple tablespoons of olive oil. And what we're going to do different about this salsa is it's not going to be a raw salsa. We're going to roast these vegetables off, get them a little caramelized, and that's also going to evaporate some of the moisture in the onions and the tomatillos, which will make the sauce a little bit thicker and give it great flavor. So now it's got nice and caramelized. You can kind of see that it's cooked down a little bit. And we're going to take this and put it in the food processor. So I've got probably about a cup of basil here. I'm going to add another toe of raw garlic, and we're going to pulse this. That's pretty good. I'm going to add a little bit of lemon juice to it.
At this point, you can add some raw vegetables to give the salsa a nice crunch. Chef Orr has a great recipe for jazzing up store-bought salsa with fresh herbs from the garden. That's on our website. And since we are talking about all things green, check out 2 recipes for guacamole, a traditional recipe using avocados, and then a vegan guac with sweet peas and tofu. Jumpstart your creativity at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Lori Heber, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Stephanie Solomon, Marcia Veldman, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We always enjoy your company. Thanks for being here today. I'm Annie Corrigan.